Today's Teisho will be on case. Today's Teisho will be on case 14 in the Mumon Kan, the U Men Kwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 14 is entitled Nansen Cuts the Cat in Two. Nansen Osho saw two monks of the Eastern and Western halls quarreling over a cat. He held up the cat and said, "If you can give an answer, you will save the cat. If not, I will kill it." No one could answer, and Nansen cut the cat in two. That evening, Joshu returned, and Nansen told him of the incident. Joshu took off his sandal, placed it on his head, and walked out. "If only you had been there," Nansen remarked, "you would have saved the cat." Mumon's comment. Tell me, what did Joshu mean when he put the sandal on his head? If you can give a turning word on this, you will see that Nansen's decree was carried out with good reason. If not, danger. Mumon's verse. Had Joshu been there, he would have done the opposite. When the sword is snatched away, even Nansen begs for his life. So I want to thank everybody for doing such an excellent job this morning here in the Zen Hall. Everybody was sitting very still, and that was just wonderful to see. Three sits in a row is quite a bit. Many places have a sit and then a walking meditation and then another sit. To sit for an hour and a half without moving, that's quite demanding. But the reward was obvious in this room this morning with the great stillness. That was just wonderful. And then the thunderous calling of Mu, that was just marvelous. Those of you who are not familiar with Zen may be puzzled. People have been going into the Dokusan room and screaming at the top of their lungs, like cows. Moo. Moo. In the English language, cows are thought to say moo. In our Zen temple in Washington State, Tokuganji, we were adjacent to National Forest Service land. And we would do sitting in the morning during Sesshin, and the National Forest Service land is open to cattle. In the western part of the United States, there's free grazing on national land. And we had no fence between our property and the National Forest. So cows would come over into our temple grounds and graze. We didn't have any grass, so it was a high desert, actually, like New Mexico. But cows would be wandering by. You could hear their thumping hoofs in the dirt as they walked by the Zendo. And we'd all be meditating, and we were all meditating one morning, and the cows started mooing. And Genki Roshi said, there's one difference between their moo and your moo. Theirs is not self-conscious. Isn't that wonderful? We have to work at it and not being self-conscious. They're just spontaneously calling moo. But the word moo means emptiness. And when we call moo, we're actually trying to do something in a spontaneous way. Now, there's nothing spontaneous about going into that room and calling moo. It's part of what you're supposed to do if you're working on the Mu Koan. And so in many ways it seems perfectly contrived and quite artificial. So you go into the room, you swallow hard, you straighten your back, and you try to let loose with a thunderous Mu. My teacher, Genki Roshi, the same man who said that cows mooing was more natural than ours, used to make it very difficult for us to call moo. He used to say with a laugh, if your moo can't at least knock a person off his legs, don't even bother. So we would come in and just be afraid of this feeble little moo, you know, coming out of our mouths. And it would intensify our anxiety and self-consciousness. At one point, I could not call Mu at all. I would just go in and I would try it, open my mouth, and I just couldn't do it. And I remember once Genki sort of coaxing me. He'd say, okay, come on. But it was literally like I couldn't have done it if you put a gun to my head, you know. I just couldn't do it. It took me many years, actually, to work through the Mu Koan. I was frozen for years. It seems so ridiculous, right? Go in, sit on the cushion, and call Mu. But I couldn't find it in myself to do it, because I kept feeling that anything that came out of my mouth was going to be inadequate. Inadequate, you know. The teacher used to say to me, I want to hear the voice of the universe. See? And I was afraid I would go in and I would just quack like a duck, you know. Not the voice of the universe. At least I could knock a man off his legs, at the very least, you know. So it was dispiriting, actually, to me, not to be able to call Mu. And I worked on the Mu Koan for a number of years. And I would go to Sesshin, and I would sit on the cushion and go, Mu, Mu, and my mind would be blank and dark. And I lived in that darkness for Sesshin, 5 or 6 Sesshins, maybe 4, 5, 6 sessions a year for a number of years. And then, one day, I went in and I had given up all hope of answering the Mu Koan. I had gone to this session just for the hell of it, you know. And I used to talk to people after session, you're not supposed to discuss the contents of what goes on in Dokusan. So, you know, even if you're with your spouse, you really shouldn't discuss what happens in the Dokusan room. Really. And I never talk about it to anybody. But sometimes after our session, people would say, did you answer your koan? And other people would say, yes, I did. And I had not really answered any koans at all. And I had been practicing for a number of years. And I would, you know, session would end, and I'd be driving home with my friends, and people would say, did you answer? Yes, I did. He really liked my answer. You know? And I would think to myself, that must be so wonderful, you know, to be able to give the... Because couldn't answer my koans. I never could answer the breath perception koan. I worked watching my breath for a number of years, and the teacher finally took me off the breath koan because I was the cook, and I was a very good cook. And he said, in our system, people would be appointed tenzo for 6 months. So you'd be given the job of being the cook, and it would be your job to do all the cooking or all the purchasing of food and everything for 2 or 3 sessions a year. And you really wouldn't have much of a chance to sit, but you would have to you were full-time producing meals, so you could maybe do a little sitting between meals. But it was a real sacrifice for people to give up half a year of their training to cook for everybody else. And I had been working on the breath perception koan for a year or two and getting nowhere, going to these sessions, and everybody would go, oh yes, he really loved my answer, you know. In fact, I was driving home with this woman whose name was Regina. She was my friend Bill's girlfriend at the time. She was a dancer and she was quite attractive. And she was working on the breath perception koan. And when she was driving home, she did something she shouldn't have done. She said, yes, I answered the koan. And Bill said, what answer did you give her? You give him. And she said, I said, peach. Peach. So I'm ashamed to say I went in once and said, peach. Because I hadn't a clue. And I was really quite backward as a Zen student. You know, it created a lot of anxiety. All my friends would be racking up the koans, and I would come home. But there was still something about Zen that was very liberating to me. Actually, later in my career as a Zen student, just so you don't think I was a totally hopeless person, I moved very quickly in my later training. But my early period was very slow, and partly that's because I was so blocked conceptually, and I lived so much in my discriminating intellect. But under the surface, a lot was going on. Most of the processing that happens when you're working with a koan is unconscious. So Zen is rather distinctive in its emphasis on the power of the unconscious as a means of liberation. So we don't use imagination in particular, or images, or ritual particularly, but these koans that we work with are really ways of activating elements of the unconscious. And so they're meant to be processed at a deeper level than a conscious level. So I was working on my koans and I felt blocked consciously, but a lot was going on underneath. And finally, I passed the breath perception koan because Genki just said, let me just back up a little bit. I was working on the breath perception koan for a number of years, 2 years, I think. And then I was asked to be Tenzo, the cook. And I didn't want to be Tenzo. I thought, God damn it, I don't want to be the cook. You know, I want to answer my koan. This is just another obstacle in my way. But of course, I didn't say that to Genki Roshi because it was so obviously selfish that I kept it to myself. So when he said, would you like to be the cook? Of course, I said, oh, I would be honored. You know, and I was thinking, not. I had worked in restaurants after I got out of college, and I actually liked to cook. And basically, I really got into cooking. It was like a magic spell. I found myself interested in preparing really good meals. And I really enjoyed cooking at the sashin. I found that this really was liberating for me. It made me feel really good. And I did, like, way over the top. You know, I was, like, way over the top. I baked bread. You know, I made bread. I did stuff like that. And people came to, you know, usually sashin food in our group was terrible. You know, it was like white rice, some boiled vegetables, you know. And it was really people who were just uninspired. And I was... baked bread, I was doing sushi, you know, vegetarian sushi, stuff like that. And everybody would come, oh my, you know, you could just see their faces light up, and I felt so good. And anyway, I worked my ass off. When we were coming back from the sashin, after the sashin, I was in a car with some friends, and They said I fell asleep in mid-sentence. I was just so exhausted. But at the end of the session, Genki Roshi called me into the Dokusan room and he said, you know, I'm going to go ahead and let you go on to the Mu koan, even though you haven't really passed the breath perception koan, because this is the first time I've seen you do something that was really selfless. And you know, naturally, I was very moved by that because I hadn't tried to be selfless, but just the joy of helping others made a big difference to me. You know, it transformed me in ways I didn't expect. So anyway, I went on to do the Mu Koan, and that too took a long time. It took a number of years, and I had really given up on any thought of passing the Mu Koan. And we were having a sesshin in our mountain temple, which was not finished at that time. And there were no windows in the zendo. And the Dokusan room was the kitchen. And we would all line up along the pathway to the kitchen. We'd sit down waiting for Dokusan. And people would run up the stairs into the kitchen and do Dokusan with Genki Roshi and then run back down. And it was very early in the morning, and I was a little groggy, and I had no expectations about answering my koan anymore. I'd given up on that very possibility, and I went in and I called Mu, and it came out of me so spontaneously that I was astounded. It was like, what the hell? And Genki Roshi, you know, was laughing, and I felt a little bit like I was in a trance. I didn't quite know what had happened to me. But it was like my unconscious mind opened, my conscious mind opened up, and my unconscious mind flooded in. And for a minute, I had like a superhuman energy, really. People have this reservoir of energy, of enlightened energy. And we normally get very boxed up, very boxed in. And so we don't really know how to access this. And Zen practice is all about learning how to break through these chains, these walls that we've created around ourselves, not by ourselves, but the whole society has created these obstacles. And liberating this fundamentally enlightened energy, you know, which people know exists in theory, but nobody really believes that it's in them, right? That's quite typical. So, you know, it's easy to see a statue of the Buddha and think, you know, people have come to Sesshin, and I've actually seen them do bows in front of the statue of the Buddha in the dining room. And that's really wonderful. But those same people would have a much harder time believing that this enlightened energy is in themselves than they would that it's in some being in a celestial realm. This is our problem. So anyway, when people come into the Dokusan room, what they're trying to do is to part the curtains or open the door into this unconscious, the deep unconscious mind, which is this fundamentally enlightened energy. And it's a struggle because we don't believe it's there. We don't. And we don't trust the process. We don't. You know. But sooner or later, an opening occurs. And it's like being possessed. It's like divine possession, you could say. You know, there's this beautiful, compassionate energy that reaches out and moves through your body as you're calling Mu. You know, this can be earth-shattering or it can be more ordinary, but answering the Mu Koan is the first time the barrier between your conscious mind and your unconscious mind has fallen away. And usually there's this rush of energy and sometimes of joy, like happiness, you know. And so this is what's going on when people are doing all this insane screaming. You know, it's really not what you might think. It's not like primal scream therapy or something like that. This has a different purpose. It's learning how to trust what we call in Zen your true nature, your fundamentally enlightened nature. And it's very hard for us to trust that. Why is it so hard? When we grow up, we're subject to a long process of socialization. And that usually involves all kinds of expectations and lessons and rules. And it's impossible to be a self without these things. What we learn to do, if you want to put it this way, is that you become a self by closing little by little that door to your big mind. That's how you become a self. That's actually the truth. So you learn as you're growing up to be a self by learning how to close down certain aspects of your world. This is true, I think. The best example of this I can possibly think of is I have told this story several different ways. I once told my wife that I told this story in a Taisho, and she was so embarrassed she made me promise never to say it again. So I changed the identity, and I said it was somebody I know. A friend of my wife's. But it was really my wife. And if you tell, you'll get me into a lot of trouble. When my wife was a little girl, she used to like to take off all her clothes and go outside after it rained and sit in the puddles and pee-pee. Basically in New Mexico, it doesn't always rain, you know. And when she was living, at that time their house was really on the edge of town. And so she used to love, she was a little kid, very small. She'd love to just, when it would rain, she'd go out and take her pants off and sit in a puddle and just let the warm pee-pee run out. And it would be warm and sunny, and she loved that. And then her mother would yell at her and tell her to come in and, what have you done? Look at you, you're a mess. There's a kind of, natural spontaneity to that, right? That's really a wonderful way to encounter the world, I would say, how delicious, really, if you think about it. And yet, it's prohibited. in Western culture, we're not allowed to play with our food, right? We're just not, that's absolutely one of the first lessons you ever learn is you don't touch your food with your fingers, little babies, if you give them food, will start playing with it. My sister, when she was a little baby, she had a serving dish, and there was a little plug in the dish. It was a ceramic dish with a hollow inside, and you were supposed to take the plug off and pour hot water into the hole, and then put the plug back on so the baby's food would be very, very warm. It's absurd, really, But anyway, my mother had three kids, so after a while the plug disappeared, right? And she would serve my sister, and my sister was fascinated by this hole. And she would start shoving food down in that hole, and it was fascinating to her, right? It was like, can I fill it up? And this is prohibited. We don't do this. And we don't play with our food. This is not done. These are small things. And of course, I'm not saying your parents did you an injustice by telling you couldn't, play with your food. But it's little by little, it's like how we experience the world becomes smaller in certain ways. Now, part of the function of education is to try to open it up again. So we close it down and then we try to open it up again in limited ways, in limited socially acceptable ways. But we do go through this process, at least from the Zen standpoint, of getting closed down and becoming stiff, rigid, and increasingly fearful, actually. You know, this is a sort of a human tragedy that we're fundamentally, from the Zen standpoint, we're fundamentally infinite beings, but we learn how to fence everything in so that that openness is concealed from us, you know. By the time we're adults, if we're not careful, by the time you're about 40 years old, your life can be very rigid and routinized. That's one of the great tragedies, actually, of life, is that instead of opening up, life becomes a process of closing down, you know. So Zen is really trying to recover this openness that we experienced, have experienced at various moments in our lives, this sense of oneness, right? Sometimes you just walk outside and the moon is in the sky and the wind is blowing and it's summer and you just feel totally connected, right? So those moments are still available, but so often our experience isn't like that. And it's because of this process of closing down that we've gone through. So, you know, Zen practice is about unlearning or dismantling the barriers that create the self. The self is the barriers. The self is made up of these barriers. Little by little, through our koan training, we take away this wall and that wall and this door. And the idea is to create this great open space where this boundless compassion can blow through like a mighty wind, you know. Now, the koan today is, which I'm just about to get to as I'm out of time. The koan today is upsetting. You know, the theme of the koans this week has been upsetting koans. Right? So we looked earlier at a koan where somebody slaps somebody else in the face. We looked at a koan where somebody tells somebody to shut up, right? And today we're looking at a koan where a great Zen master cuts a cat in half. So that's the theme this week. This would have been considered like scandalous in the context of Chinese Buddhism. The idea of hurting anything is, of course, prohibited. And cutting a cat in two is a shocking act from a great enlightened teacher. The story is that Nansen, the great master Nansen, was running a Zen center, basically a Zen temple. And there were two wings to the temple. There was an east wing and a west wing. And in the east wing, there were one group of monks, and in the west wing, there were another group of monks. And somebody had adopted a cat. And the two groups of two sides of the monastery became rivals in a struggle over the ownership of the cat. This probably sounds familiar. The West Wing would, say, the cat is ours. You guys have no right to the cat. And then over in the East Wing, they would, come here, kitty, you want some milk, you know? And then say, well, the kitty doesn't want to go back to you. You know, he wants to be over here. And then they would argue all the time about who owns the cat. And there would be, people would spread rumors. Do you know what they do over there? Oh my God, they really mistreated the cat. And it's like, oh, those monsters, you know. Human, right? Human. And everybody became very attached to one view of things or another. And in other words, they became prisoners of this process of closing things down. I mean, it could have been so wonderful, right, to have a cat in the Zen temple, we could all enjoy the kitty, but it's tied in with identity, it's tied in with insecurities, so many human problems. And so one day, Nansen just can't stand it anymore. And he comes into the temple and he says, there's just too much bullshit going on here. You know, there's too many fights over nothing that matters. And he said, I want one person to say an enlightened word. Just manifest your true nature, your fundamentally enlightened nature in some way, and I will save this cat. But if you can't do it, I'll cut it right in half. And nobody can do it. Everybody's just locked into their trapped minds. You know. And he cuts the cat in two. And then later that night, his best student, Joshu, comes back, and maybe Nansen's actually crying. You know, I always think of this story as he's in his room and he's actually crying that he cut the cat in two. And he says to Joshu, look, you know, I just couldn't think of any other way to cut through the bullshit. You know, and I know that I will be karmically punished for what I've done. But I did it as an act of compassion. And he says, what would you have done? And Joshu puts his shoe on his head and leaps through the door. And Nansen says, you know, oh man, if only you had been here, it would have saved the cat. You see. So, you know, basically, this koan could be a literal story. It could be true, literally true. Maybe it's a historical story. But it also has to do about how we get through our obstacles. How we get through our obstacles. You know? What it takes to be set free, you know. We create these artificial goals, these artificial objectives, these artificial rules, and we define ourselves so much in that way, you know, by that. And we become, it's like we're dreamers, or we're like storytellers who create these stories, but after a while, they start to frighten us. It's like we're telling ghost stories, but after a while, we forget we created the ghost story, and then we're afraid to go out at night. This is how humans really are. You know, we create a symbolic universe, and then we begin to think of it more and more as absolutely unchangeable, and so on and so on. A friend of mine recently was passed over for a raise, and it was so interesting to see him because, first of all, he had been hoping for a raise. And his boss passed him over and gave it to somebody else. And my friend fell into real dejection. He was really, you know, like bummed out. He was almost depressed. And when he was telling me about it, he was so jealous of this other person. And he was so, he felt so injured because he had been passed over for a promotion. And it probably was unfair. But you know, I could see so easily that his life was a really good life. You know, he was secure in his job. He has a beautiful house. He makes plenty of dough. You know, it's like, you know, I said, you know, people would envy you. You know, the life you led, and it was just that was just went one ear in one ear and out the other. It's like, you know, he was just fiercely injured. But everything was. His life was great. Most people would be, you know, would give an eye tooth to have a life like that. You know, it was just such a great life. He couldn't appreciate it. He felt so injured. This is so human, right? You know, we have goals and dreams, and it's good to pursue them, right? It's good to pursue them. But you know, it sometimes takes a crisis or a disappointment or a loss, you know, to break free. You know, if you have a goal and you set out to accomplish it and you accomplish it, you might feel really good, you know. But that might not really be liberating, right? It might not really be liberating. It's a cliche, but sometimes the experience of failure or loss can open you up in a way that success can't do. You know, and a lot of koan practice, can feel, sometimes it can feel like a loss. You know, when you're working through a difficult koan, it's really asking you to experience the world in a new way, in a different way. And that means you have to give up the old way, you know. Sometimes when people answer their koans, so to speak, it's at the end of a difficult process where they go through a lot of fear, you know, and sometimes, not always, sometimes you just sit and you come in and you answer the koan. But some koans are really difficult because they're asking us to confront barriers in ourselves and to really change. And that usually feels like a bit of a loss at first, you know. And it was certainly like that for me when I answered the Mu Koan. You know, I had started out my Zen career thinking that I was, you know, I mean, I have to say, you might think less of me. But, you know, I had grown up reading a lot of baloney about Tibet, and I had read these ridiculous books by this guy named Lobsang Rampa, who wasn't really a Tibetan at all. But he claimed that people in Tibet could communicate telepathically. These books were wildly popular, Lobsang Rampa. And basically, he claimed that, you know, he was Tibetan monks could fly through the air on kites and stuff like that. It was totally made up. And they sold hundreds of thousands of copies all over the world. So I read this kind of stuff, and, you know, I have to say, when I started Zen, I had this fantasy. I was going to go in and meet the Zen master, and he was going to go, you know, grasshopper, it's good to see you again, or my old teacher, reborn, you know. I've been looking for you, my old teacher, now you're here, you know. Really, I mean, I had that fantasy. I had the fantasy, you know, he'll recognize that I'm really a reincarnated lama, you know, something like that. So basically, I started Zen practice with high hopes of being a reincarnated lama who would be discovered. And then I couldn't answer any of my koans, right? And like everybody else, I had been socialized. You know, I was a total nerd in high school. I was no good at sports. I wasn't really cut out for being a ladies' man, you know. So there was nothing left for me but to try to be good in school. And I could get good grades, you know, with some work. So I had defined myself as being a good scholar, good student. And I always got, like, very good grades. And if I didn't get good grades, I felt bad about myself. So I worked very hard to always get top marks, you know. And I would get a little award or something, and my parents would pat me on the head and say I was a good boy. So when I started doing Zen practice and I started getting bad marks, it was really depressing for me, right? Because I would go to Sesshin, I would give it a good shot, I would go in to see Genki Roshi, and I would present my answer, and he would go, no. In a Zen temple, Roshi just has a little bell. It's like a little handbell, and he tinkles it. So you go in, and, you know, if you're working on the breath perception, I remember once I wrote a poem, and it was something like, death is a mirror, bright and clear, that shows the truth when we draw near. Really, I mean, I was just an idiot. You know? I was a typical nerd, 22-year-old nerd, right? And a bad poet. So I went in to see Genki Roshi, and I recited this poem, and it would just be the bell, right? Ding, 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 ding. That meant get out, you know. So, that was like a bad mark. And so I'd go to Sesshin, And I'd go in and give him my incredibly ridiculous answers, and he'd ring the bell, and that meant sorry. And you know, and then I'd drive home from Sesshin, and I'd hear people say, "Oh yeah, I answered another koan. I don't know how I do it," you know. And all these people I admired were answering their koans. And, you know, it's like 4 or 5 years into this process, I was like the, you know, at the bottom of my class, so to speak, right? And this gnawed away at me, and yet I loved Zen. Sitting made me feel so much better. Sitting made me lift. I think I had been depressed, and sitting really solved the problem of depression for me and made me feel really much better. But at the same time, I was failing to be a good Zen student, you know. And this was very painful for me, you know. It was something I had never encountered before, this experience of loving something but not being successful at it, you know. And then I think it just gradually made it possible for me to break through. It was a long, painful experience of failure. But as I said, you know, I just finally just gave up. I thought I might never, you know, I'll be in Zen for 30 years and I will never have answered a koan. You know, it's like being in the first grade for life, right? And I sort of was resigned to that, because actually there was something about Zen, I couldn't explain it, but it was just so gripping and it was so wonderful, even though I was getting bad marks. And I went in to see Genki Roshi, and I just opened my mouth and I called Mu, and something happened, you know. And I think that was difficult, because I had to sort of like, I had to really lose something. You know, I had to lose this illusion of myself as the great undiscovered reincarnated Lama. And I had to lose an image of myself as somebody who's, you know, got his act together and can achieve his goals and so on. And I no longer knew who I was or what I was doing. And then something really wonderful happened. You know, and I must say, after I called Mu, Genki seemed very pleased. And he said, "How do you feel?" And I felt like I had a breaking heart. You know, it was like my heart is breaking. And that was something else I didn't expect, right? You know, I feel like my heart is breaking. And he said, "Well, let it break. Please let it break." So this koan is about how we open up. You know, cutting the cat in two. Nobody likes to be cut in two. Nobody likes to be cut in two. You know, we like to have our integrity intact. We like to have our dreams fulfilled. We like to have our plans realized, you know. But that's very difficult to grow under those circumstances. Sometimes things happen to us and it hurts. It really hurts. And that's when we can drop the small self and connect to the larger self. And I must say, in my own life, I've had many disappointments, you know. Sometimes I've sat down on the cushion and I've been really down. And, you know, and I'll focus on my breath and I'll enter emptiness. And then after a while, it might take a whole session, but it's just like the walls go down and it's open in all directions. And I feel absolutely alive. This is like going from the bottom to the top, you know. And maybe that's the price we have to pay sometimes for waking up. You know. So being cut in two, if you want to wake up, you have to be cut in two sooner or later. We're all cut in two all the time. But you know, you can let it close you down, or you can let it open, you can use it to open yourself up. And the difference is the zazen, right? I mean, you sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath, and, you know, whatever your obstacles are, they're going to become apparent to you. And you keep cutting away and cutting away and going deeper into emptiness. And all of a sudden, you know, it's the miracle of Zen, you know? It's the miracle of Zen. All of a sudden, everything becomes effortless. It's like the unfolding. You know, Ilusha had to leave early. He came here for our Sesshin, and then just before he left, he got a call from NPR. Ilusha's a musician. He got a call from NPR, and they said, we want you to be on the radio show Soundcheck. So he had to leave after several days here at Sesshin. But he told me, you know, he said, about a year ago, he had to give a concert right after Sesshin. And he said he was very nervous about the concert. It was a lot was riding on it. And he said, I went to Sesshin. He said, I had to go straight from Sesshin to the concert. And he said, when I got to the concert, he said, it was effortless. He said, it was amazing. You know? And that's happened to me. That's the magic of Zazen. That's the magic of letting go. I didn't ask him if he felt heartbroken or not. Maybe he didn't. You know. But sometimes waking up is like feeling heartbroken. You know. So anyway, you don't have to be heartbroken to answer your koan. You know. But it might happen. And you don't. You shouldn't try to be heartbroken. Just be natural. But it's definitely the case that doing Zazen, doing Zen, requires working through our illusions. And when we lose our illusions, we lose the self, right? I mean, the self is a structure of illusions. And that's all there is to the self, really, is a bunch of closed doors. Doesn't mean you shouldn't love yourself and take care of yourself. That's where you live, right? The self is your room. And you keep it neat and clean. And you love, you know, you go to bed at night and look around and you see the pictures you've used to decorate the walls. And you say, what a lovely room, right? So I'm not saying you should disparage yourself or mistreat yourself. But ultimately, when the walls go down, it's pretty wonderful. So please keep practicing, okay? Nansen Osho saw monks at the Eastern and Western halls quarreling over a cat. He held up the cat and he said, if you can give an answer, you will save the cat. If not, I will have to kill it. No one could answer and Nansen cut the cat in two. That evening, Joshu returned and Nansen told him of the incident. Joshu took off his sandal, placed it on his head and walked out. If you had been there, Nansen said, you would have saved the cat. Wumon's comment, tell me, what did Joshu mean when he put the sandal on his head? If you can give a turning word on this, you will see that Nansen's decree was carried out with good reason. If not, look out. Wumon's verse, had Joshu been there, he would have done the opposite. In other words, there's a sword that gives life. There's a sword that gives life instead of taking life away. That's the sword Joshu uses. And it's the sword that cuts through the walls. It's the sword that cuts through our expectations about what should be happening. So, cut, cut, cut.